Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Sudan, talking a little bit specifically about what has been going on in this country, and now that it is both trying to recover from a very long civil war and also deal with continuing conflict in various places like Darfur, which we've heard about really since 2003, where there has been conflict. A lot of people have died. Many more people have been forced from their homes. And our guest for the program is Matito Watson. He's Deputy Field Office Director for the group Save the Children Sudan. And this is a group that not only works in Sudan, but also does international relief work a lot of other places around the world as well. So partly what we want to talk a little bit about is how non-governmental organizations generally, and this one also specifically, work to try to help people in places like Sudan. He's here in the area visiting family, and I'm glad that he can be here. He was actually supposed to be here earlier in the week, and we had a little bit of confusion, and we're sorry about that, but we're glad that he's here on the program this morning. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest. He worked in Senegal and Guinea as a Peace Corps volunteer. He's also conducted workshops in Cameroon aimed at countering the spread of HIV/AIDS. He also worked in Eritrea with the Eritrean Ministry of Education to train new Peace Corps volunteers. And he is also a graduate of the University of Illinois. He has degrees in both African studies and community health. And as I said, we're pleased that she could be here with us this morning. And questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Just to start, you want to talk just a little bit about Save the Children?
Yeah, Save the Children is one of the world's leading organizations that provides both humanitarian and development work for children around the world. We are active in 40 countries, as well as the United States of America. We were one of the first organizations that responded to the Katrina hurricane here in the USA. I've been with the organization for 5 years now, mostly been based in Africa. And we do a wide range of programming to improve children's lives. We're looking for lasting positive change in the lives of children in need. Mm-hmm. Everything from immediate humanitarian emergency response all the way to much more long-term self-sufficient development kinds of activities.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Sudan. Now, recently, if people are paying attention to the news, they will know that there now for several years has been this continuing crisis, very, very bad situation in the western Sudan in this place called Darfur. It has drawn the concern of people around the world. The United States government actually, I think, has gone as far as to say that they believe that there was genocide going on there. I don't think the United Nations has taken that step. However, I know that the United Nations representatives of the United Nations have said that it was one of the most serious humanitarian crises going anywhere. And this is in the context of a place where there had been, as I mentioned, there had been a very long civil war, more than 20 years, this one between forces based in the north and based in the south. And that finally seems to have gotten settled. But then there are these additional problems, and they have at least partly to do with people in other parts of the country, particularly the west, but also in the east, who felt somehow left out of the settlement of the war and saying, you know, they're feeling that their interests weren't being acknowledged. I know that it's very complicated. What do you think it's important for people to know about Sudan?
Well, I think looking at from my perspective out on the field compared to what we're seeing with a lot of international media, they like to boil a very complex, very convoluted situation down to a couple of very short sound bites. And for us working out in the field, it's more than just the Arabs versus the Africans out in Darfur. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated, long-term inter-ethnic conflicts. It's issues around who has possession of oil and certain land areas. It's issues over control in certain areas and people getting appropriate representation. Sudan is a huge country when I fly, I'm based out of Khartoum, and when I fly from Khartoum out to Darfur, it's like a four-hour flight. It's like flying from here to Denver, Colorado, or something like that. So there's a lot going on there, and I think that the nuances, and some of these nuances I think are very delicate, are often not what's really represented in the international media. And people like to take very strong, broad brushstrokes on solutions or summing it up, which we feel sometimes just doesn't really much accurately describe the situation that's kind of going on the ground. However, for us, I'm part of a non-governmental organization, and we're looking at providing relief, access to children, being able to get out and do work in Darfur. So often we leave a lot of those kinds of peace negotiations and treaties and conventions at the very high levels of government with the UN. And the U.S. has certainly been a player with the North-South peace agreement. So for us, we're basically looking at finding a solution so that we are able to have access to the most vulnerable children out there to get out and do the work that we want to do.
Hmm. Well, it's obviously a very dangerous situation to work in. And I guess it was my understanding that even for outsiders, it was very difficult even to get into Darfur. How do you deal with the with just the fact that it's just dangerous just to be there?
We have a lot of very strict security protocols that we follow while we're out in the field. And every day, as part of the senior management of the team, both in Sudan and as well back here in the States, we evaluate the risk to our staff out in the field in a very sometimes hostile. We do work very closely with the African Union, the AU, and with the UN to keep our finger on the pulse of really what's happening out there. And on a day by day, we have briefings on where are no-go areas, where are areas that we have access to. We were one of the first organizations to respond. We've been working in Sudan for more than 20 years. We started back in 1985 during the famine that happened in the central Sudan area. And we're able to gear up very, very quickly. Currently, we're the largest organization working out in West Darfur based out of Janina. And for us, it's very, very strict security protocols. Currently, we're unable to travel by road to the various internally displaced people or IDP camps, where we have many of our activities and our programs. We are using UN helicopters, AU helicopters, to get around so that we aren't targets to the Janjaweed or the banditry that is out there. Part of why I like working for Save the Children is that there's always an element of building capacity at the local level. So from day one, we have worked with the displaced individuals to provide them with the knowledge and the skills to do the programming. So now, more than 2 years later into this conflict out in Western Sudan, we don't need to go out every day to the IDP camps. Our staff on the ground are able to keep our programs going, and we can strategically use the sometimes very expensive helicopters to make sure that we're getting medicines, some key staff members out, other essential items out to the IDP camps where they're needed the most. Mm.
So how many people do you have doing this work?
We're huge. Currently, right now, we have, it varies, between 1,300 and 1,400 staff. Most of that are national staff, Sudanese. We have right around 30 expatriates on the ground right now that provide the management as well as some of the technical expertise. But that we are phasing that out as more and more of the Sudanese staff are able to kind of fill in these very specialized positions because they've been trained over the past several years.
Mm-hmm. I know that there are places around the world where people conflicts like these are going on, and relief workers, people who do the kind of work you do, have been actually deliberately targeted. So it's not just accidental that might get hurt. It's deliberate that the parties who are involved in this kind of fighting and this kind of sort of lawlessness and chaos, apparently they think anybody who is trying to bring order to the situation is trouble. So they want to get rid of people like you.
Or in much as the cases where we've had trouble in the past, we have certain assets that those individual groups are looking for. You know, quite frankly, it's a little disturbing to see how the face of war has changed over the past 50 years. I mean, if you look at some of the international legal conventions, tools that were pulled together after World War II with the Geneva Conventions. Women and children should be off limits. Clergy, the media, humanitarian aid workers, those people who have surrendered, the wounded. There's certain actual, in all that chaos, should be some rules with that. But with the changes of technology over the year, smaller, lighter weapons, more communication, the information age, as well as much more civil wars rather than the big, large-scale international world wars, more and more civilians are being targeted. More and more humanitarian workers are targeted. There's less control over kind of the rules of engaging in war. So for us, it's amazing now that the rebel groups will target the humanitarian workers because they want the laptops and the long-range radios and the satellite phones as ways that they are now able to use those effectively in how they are conducting war. And secondly is the use of methods of terror, whether they're using sexual violence as a way to terrorize civilians. I worked for 3 years with the conflict in West Africa with Sierra Leone and Liberia. At one point in time, they were mutilating individuals by cutting off their arms, their nose, their ears as a way to terrorize and keep control and chaos going, which can be key part in being effective in how people conduct war. But unfortunately, this means that much more civilians, especially women and children, are much more vulnerable and targeted.
Yeah. That's interesting. I guess when you were talking about the fact that combatants in situations like this might be interested in things that you would have, right away I thought, oh, well, food and medicine. I guess I wasn't thinking about cell phones and laptops as being something that would be – I can understand that they would, but that was not the first thing that I thought about.
And actually, I mean, the way that we work is that we are nonpartisan. We do try to – you know, we as an organization – can't really take sides. If there are children or injured on either side, we do try to, you know, if we can have safe access to those groups. Part of our mandate is the fact that we, regardless of race, age, creed, affiliation, whatever, to be able to provide assistance, especially immediate life-saving assistance, to any side. Mm-hmm. So also kind of technically as well, those individuals should have access to health care and to food. But unfortunately, the way that wars are often fought, it's not always a fair game.
Yeah. Our guest, let me reintroduce this morning. We're talking with Matita Watson. He is the Deputy Country Office Director for Save the Children in Sudan and has been with Save the Children for about 5 years now, mostly working in Africa. He also worked in Senegal and Guinea as a Peace Corps volunteer and has worked other places as well, Cameroon and Eritrea. He is visiting here in the area, has some family here, and we're pleased that he could be here a little bit on the program to talk with us about the work of his and other non-governmental organizations that work in conflict situations like that in Sudan. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, when you have a situation here, again, as in Darfur, where we have a lot of people who have been forced out of their homes, and so they're living in refugee camps, where they have a lot of immediate needs for food, for health care, security, which is maybe a little bit beyond what an organization like yours can provide. As you try to address particularly the basic needs, what going beyond that, though, you have other things that you're trying to do that you think are also very important.
Exactly. I mean, often the way that humanitarian response plays out, people usually think their gut reaction, food, water, shelter, health care, let's take care of those things right away. Our work over the past 75 years here in the United States of America and abroad has shown that children have special needs, and children are particularly vulnerable any time that there's these conflicts. Because children have special needs in order for them to reach their maximum development, we feel that the protection of children, social protection of children, and education also must be included as part of the immediate response. The work that we've done where we've been able to do emergency educations in emergency situations such as during the tsunami in Indonesia, some of our work in West Africa, what we're doing now in Darfur, what we've just done most recently in Lebanon and Israel, is that children are resilient. They can bounce back from witnessing atrocities. They can bounce back from a lot of things, provided that they have the space and support for them to recover. Some children, the most vulnerable, such as survivors of sexual exploitation, child soldiers, individuals that have been involved in trafficking, separated children, may need a little bit more intensive interventions to get them back into their society, get them back on their feet. But most of the children, if we're able to provide that sense of normalcy, a place, safe place for them to go, and at the same time, they're continuing to learn and to develop. For example, if you look at what happened in Liberia, you had more than almost 20 years of a civil war going on there. So children who may have made it to fourth or fifth grade all of a sudden were out of school for a period of 5 years. During that period of 5 years, they almost regressed as far back as to first grade or kindergarten. They had lost a lot of that retention of what they have learned, you know, thus far. In order for us to be able to recover from war, and in order for these children, which are going to be the future leaders of these countries, to be able to deal with what has happened to them and to their families during war, we've got to provide them with the tools that they can recover, that they can process this, and then take that forward to the next generation. So I work for Save the Children U.S., and we are a U.S.-based organization. We have offices in Connecticut and Washington, D.C., but we're part of a much bigger picture. We're part of what we call the Save the Children Alliances, and there's 39 alliance members from around the world. There's Save the Children UK, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Spain, etc. And we have come together with a campaign called Rewrite the Future, where right now there are 43 million children out of school because of conflict. These children are stagnating. These children are losing ground. These children are also much more vulnerable to malnutrition. They're much more vulnerable to exploitation. They're much more vulnerable to not having access to good health care or clean water. We feel that by providing schooling immediately on the onset of an emergency or natural disaster, that we can save more children's lives, as well as allow a space for children to snap back to recover from the impacts of war.
Mm-hmm. I think this is very interesting, and I think that some people might. Well, I'm sure that they would say, well, it sounds like a good thing, but that they might be a little surprised that when you would be looking at a situation like that, either you're dealing with war or dealing with natural disaster, that that making sure that kids have the continued opportunity to have education and to have some school, that would be such a priority. I can, as you've outlined, I can see that makes perfect sense, but that it's maybe not the kind of thing that people are going to think of right away. They will probably think of the more immediate needs that people would have for food, basically for food, for shelter, for security, for health, for some kind of medical care, you know, all those sorts of things. Those are the things that you think of as being emergency kind of needs that you, on the very first day that you're dealing with that kind of thing. I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, you know, I hadn't really thought about now that you now that you mention it, I understand that it's important, but it's not really something that I would have thought about as being one of those things that right from the beginning you think, here's something that really needs to be addressed, not just for the moment, but also for the long-term future of the people and the country.
Anytime there's a conflict or a natural disaster, you see the worst of people. People go into survival mode. And not only when you're in your community, you know, there's consequences if you do something wrong. There's the legal consequences from the police or the state. And then there's also the social consequences that happen that your neighbors, you don't want your neighbors to think poorly of you. When those communities are shattered and people are put into situations where they're a little bit more invisible and they're in a survival mode, sometimes you see the worst things that kind of come out. And children are so vulnerable because they need their families to protect them, or they need someone to be able to provide them with food or provide them with water or to make sure that nothing bad happens to them. And if they're separated from their families, or that their families are now so disempowered that they're not able to be able to protect the children, then that's where we start to see a lot of these problems that come out with sexual exploitation, children disappearing, recruitment of children into armed groups. Also, because children can't fight to the front of the line sometime. I mean, unless us, like an organization, is very much aware that children have special nutritional needs and that we need to make sure that they're getting access to the food that is delivered to the household, that that's not all going to the men or not all going to the older brothers and sisters, that the children are able to be able to have access to the food that we distribute in order to ensure their survival. So through the school, we are able then, for example, to have health screenings. Through the school, we're able to provide hot meals every day. Through the school, we're able to provide essential education on water and sanitation, you know, washing your hands, using a latrine. And when you have people who are living in a very small village now in very tight, high population refugee camps or IDP camps, these kinds of things are essential for success. I mean, we're constantly looking about the levels so that there's not a cholera outbreak, or if you have a meningitis outbreak, it'll just spread from one person to the other. And because people, everybody's impacted by war and conflict, immune systems are weakened. So by focusing through the school, I think that we are able to provide a lot more life-saving interventions targeted towards children. And not only are we dealing with more of the long term and more, what you know, the softer kinds of things where children have an opportunity to forget about the war for a few hours a day, we're also able to provide much more successful health care, much more successful nutrition, clean water, the other life-saving interventions that we're sure now are able to make it to the children.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about the fact that Save the Children was one of those organizations, maybe was the first to be on the scene and try to do work after the tsunami that took place, and that would have been December of 2004. Now, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, December 2004. One of the things we know about that a lot of families were devastated. There were people who lost their children, and I'm sure that there were children who lost their parents, and that we would have ended up with a lot of kids that were orphans who didn't have family. Does that happen a lot? And do you actually have to deal with significant numbers of children that are alone in the world?
Yeah, and that's where we see a lot of children having to do things, fulfilling adult roles, because maybe sometimes these children will be with their younger siblings. Mm-hmm. The parents may be out in the field when the attack comes on the village, or the kids are at school and when the tsunami hit and the parents are at home and they just happen to go in different directions. We do actually do what we call family tracing and reunification programs. So when we are working in the camps, or if there is a mass movement of people, we immediately have trained staff on the ground to look for children that may be alone or look for children that are in kind of a weird situation. Like you may have an older man with a younger girl and the two people are dressed very, very differently. And you're like, whoa, this could be a possible guy that's picked up this girl for not good reasons. So we immediately start screening for children who may have these problems. And we do find children that are separated from their families, from their biological parents or their primary caregivers. We work within the community to find foster families that can temporarily take care of these children until we can find their families. In cases where the family is the child is an orphan, it gets much more complicated, because then we deal with the state and trying to figure out what will be the long-term solution for these children. Some of these children at 8, 9, 10 years of age have forced into adulthood early and take care of their brothers and sisters. Unfortunately, a lot of that is for girls through commercial sex work in order to survive. For boys, thuggery, thievery, that kind of thing, odd jobs. And if you look at what has happened in West Africa, especially around the blood diamond trade, a lot of these kids have been kind of sold into slavery in digging for diamonds. Mm. So then we work with those kids in order, either if to foster, some of them may be ready just to be on their own, you know, to start, you know, they're old enough at 16, 17, 18 years of age. And then we try to provide them with the skills, either vocational training or education, so that they can go out and get a job and start providing for their siblings or themselves. In fact, currently right now, we have a very big, between the North and the South, family tracing and reunification program, trying to get a lot of separated children back with their parents.
We are about our midpoint here. We have a caller, and again, I should introduce our guest, Matita Watson. He is with the group Save the Children, which is an international humanitarian relief organization that tries to work with and help children around the world. And he has, for the past 5 years or so, been with this organization, mostly working in Africa. And recently, he's been working in Sudan as part of their efforts there. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. People can join the conversation by calling us, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller in Champaign. We'll talk with them right here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm looking for someone to put my money to and my will. And my question for you is, what percentage of my dollar is used for actual relief?
That's an excellent question. And a lot of people look at the overhead. I mean, we do have overhead that we have to pay for in order for us to do the job that we do. One of the reasons I chose Save the Children as compared to some of the other organizations out there is I think that they have a pretty good ratio. I mean, we're looking at somewhere between 75 cents to 80 cents on the dollar actually goes out to the programs in the field. Some of our other programs around sponsorship, direct sponsorships, can be a little bit leaner. And it also depends on if you're looking at emergency work, which is sometimes much more expensive as compared to development work, which could have a little bit more of a higher ratio.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Other questions are indeed welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Does Save the Children get any kind of governmental money from any government?
Yeah, we're mostly grant funded organization. So right now for the emergency response in Darfur, we get our money from the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance from the U.S. government. And they have been very good and very generous in providing the funding that we need in order to go out and do the job that we have to do. We're also supported by the European Commission through their humanitarian branch, as well as some of our other alliance member partners, such as Save the Children Japan, is able to access money through the Japanese government. So governments have been very good and very responsive towards this. There's lots of competition out there. And I just, you know, if people ask what are some of the things that they can do to help these kinds of organizations, that's continue to talk to your representative or your congressman that substantial amounts of money are going for development work overseas and relief work overseas. Those are some of the things that get cut quickly. And with currently what has happened in Iraq and other areas, we've taken a cut in 2007 for what we'll be able to do in Darfur. So we've had to actually scale back some of our programs that we think are very, very important, but we're dependent on that. On the other hand, we've also had a lot of private foundations that have been very generous with us. Bill and Melinda Gates have been working with our Saving Newborn Lives program. We don't have that program in Sudan, but elsewhere. Very active also with the HIV/AIDS response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And a lot of other smaller fundraisers will be able to help. So right now, we're having trouble finding money for education because people haven't prioritized that. But some of the smaller foundations that are out there have been able to provide us with funding so that we can do schools within these IDP camps.
Yeah. And when governments provide you money, are there strings? Do they tell you what it is they want you to be doing that or with it or require you to do certain things? Or can you essentially make your own decision, set your own priorities?
Most of the time, it's fairly autonomous that we set forth that we're going to be able to do these activities ahead of time. We enter into a dialogue with the donor, and if there are strings attached that we don't agree with, there's always the opportunity for us to walk away. That's one of the other nice things about being such a large organization, that we are not dependent on every single bit of money that comes across. So I think that we have a little bit of the ability to kind of pick and choose. And on the flip side of that, being such a large organization, we can also put pressure on the government or the donors if there are strings that are attached to that that we're not comfortable with, then we can put pressure on them either through Congress or through directly through the heads of those agencies to say this isn't going to work. But we've had such a long-standing relationship with United States Overseas Development Organization and the OFDA, Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, that I think that it's almost more like a partnership that they're very kind of open to hearing. But we are always a little bit at the mercy of the administration as they go through and kind of what they decide are their priorities. They may not always match up with our priorities.
We talked a little bit earlier. You talked a little bit earlier about Darfur, and this is the aspect of Sudan that has gotten, and I'm sure will continue to get a lot of attention. And I talked about the fact, mentioned about the fact that there had actually before been this long-running civil war in Sudan that was a north-south conflict, and that seems to have been settled. What is life like in the rest of Sudan? If we take Darfur out of the picture just for a second, are things better in the rest of Sudan, particularly since the north-south conflict has been settled?
Yeah, and I'm really glad you asked that question because everybody wants to know about Darfur. We work in Darfur, as I said. We also work in what they call the three areas, which is the border between the north and the south, which was hit very hard during the 20-year civil war. And so we work in the Abyei area as well as in the Nuba Mountains, providing – and our programs in those areas are almost as big as our programs in Darfur. But we're able to do a lot more with less money because that we're not funding a lot so much towards security and that we're able to move around freely, although there are landmines in the area and we do take specific precautions. I mean, it still can be a little bit of a dangerous place. But yes, things are better for the people that we work with. And we do comprehensive work there. We do everything from putting up health clinics to building schools to putting in hand pumps and setting up latrines. A lot of work around child protection. We just recently did the demobilization of 181 former child combatants. Looking for their families, getting them reintegrated, but also much more work around livelihoods, especially agriculture. So when we're out and talking to those individuals out in the field, their piece to them is access to social services. For so many years, there's been no social services out there, having to dig shallow wells in order to get water, no health care whatsoever. So now that we do have much more free movement within the region, and we're able to work on a very much kind of a community basis. We're seeing people coming back from the larger towns like Khartoum to rebuild their villages, which have been mostly completely decimated. And we try to facilitate that as much as we possibly can by providing initially a mobile clinic and a water point as the initial starting points for people to reconstruct their villages. Things are better. It still is a little bit in the honeymoon phase of the comprehensive peace agreement. Little tiny spikes of problems here and there. And again, like Darfur, you can't simply boil down that civil war between the north and the south. I mean, it has long-running competition over who has access to the Nile and who nomads versus pastoralists and, again, oil. And it seems that where there is diamonds and oil, there will be conflict, which is tremendously unfortunate because those are resources that can help many African countries recover. But if we take Nigeria, for example, it's been much more of a curse rather than an asset. So for me, looking very closely on how the government of Sudan will be able to manage these resources for the betterment of the people. Now, in the areas where we're working, in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, there are dividends that should be being paid out to the communities. Those are still kind of locked up in red tape in the various government offices. But those kinds of things need to really start happening soon. I doubt that the people are so tired of war and they're so tired of loss. They just want peace and they just want to be healthy and send their kids to school and to have a good crop and not have to worry about, you know, to walk safely from point A to point B. But I think with war, there's always a lot of terrible things that happen, but it always does facilitate change. I think people in the region are a little bit more wiser. I think they know where to put the pressure on many of the government offices. I know they know how to talk better to the media. And I think this hopefully will very much improve the situation in that region.
Yeah. I think one point you make, I think it's important, and it seems to be something that comes up again and again in places where we have these kinds of conflicts that seem to have ethnic religious dimensions, as this one did, that one of the things that's going on, and it may indeed in turn out to be the most important thing that's going on, is a struggle over who gets to control whatever sources of wealth there are. And that was, I think, one of the big issues in this conflict, this North-South conflict. And in settling it was finding some kind of way to divide up the wealth so that everybody got something, and that indeed has something to do with the Darfur conflict, because the Darfurians, the people out there, as you say, there's a lot of other things going on, but partly it was that the people out there felt that somehow they got left out of the peace deal, and some people there felt that they had to resort to violence to get the attention of the government, and then it just went south from there. But that in this conflict, that really was a very significant thing, was trying to decide, okay, you know, there are sources of wealth, and dividing them up in a way so that everybody gets something. That was not an easy thing.
And even now, I think there is, you know, even in some of those agreements, there is still a little bit of gray area just over a tiny band of like 50 miles. And so there still is some areas where there is, you know, it is not exactly sure where the North-South divide really starts and ends. And there's this gray area about 50 miles, 200 miles in length and 50 miles across, of which the people that are living in that area are still kind of in this limbo, non-government. They don't know who they're supposed to be reporting to and who their alliances are. And the line keeps getting moved back and forth, north and south, between that 50 miles. Which for us, I mean, being on invitation to come into Sudan and to work, when the government itself is not sure exactly what they want us to do, it's tremendously frustrating for us to stand by and not be able to react or to assist, because it's a no man's land, you know. So do we work with the North or do we work with the South in this particular case?
Yeah, you talked about the fact that one of the things that you have tried to do is to reunite families in cases where children sometimes have been taken to be exploited in various kinds of ways. I know that I have read about the fact that in some of these kinds of cases, that children come back to their families and they're strangers, and that sometimes even the families in some sense view the children as tainted, that they don't want them back. Have you dealt with situations like that where it was difficult and the reuniting process was complicated by those kinds of things?
Definitely. And this is particularly in cases for girls who have been survivors of sexual violence, that families may not want them back because they're dirty, or that, you know, they won't be able to have them as they'll never be able to get married. Mm-hmm. And we never leave that to the point when we're the day where we're reuniting the families. We do quite a bit of extensive work to really get the viewpoint of the family's expectation, of the child's expectation, so there's not that tremendous disappointment. Sometimes it takes a lot of mediation, working through various cultural taboos, various ideas at the whole community level. Where I've worked previously in Africa, it's such a kind of a corny phrase, but it does kind of take a village to raise a child. And it's not just the family that makes the decisions, that if there is enough social pressure from the leadership, whether that be the old, you know, kind of traditional leaders or the village midwives, who often have a lot of power with the women, is to work through what has happened through these children, that they're not at fault. We have gone in the past to extent where we've had cleansing ceremonies with the whole community, where the child is washed with some sort of kind of magical blessed liquid, kind of reborn clean back mm-hmm. into that community. A lot of it depends on the child being able to understand and re-grasp what, you know, social behavior and what is acceptable social behavior. Many times if children have been recruited as child soldiers, they're completely broken down into just basically kind of drugged out, mindless killing machines, and they don't want them around because they're dangerous. Or that these children were forced to commit atrocities in their communities in order to prove their loyalty. Many times it's, like I said before, a survival mechanism. It was kind of a kill or be killed. So not only are the children carrying all of this baggage around of the things that they've done, of the things that have happened to them, the community is as well. And going through a very much community-based approach and using very non-confrontational medium such as dance or theater, music, imagery, paintings, drawings, it gives us a way for both sides to start to really talk about these things that sometimes are unmentionable or unspeakable but are a block for these kids to be getting back into their communities. So working with both sides, you know, I think that we have been successful in the past in rehabilitating and reintegrating a lot of these children. Not 100% success, unfortunately, but I think that these kids are definitely not lost, and families always want their children back, but they are either afraid or they're unsure what's going to happen or what has happened after they've been away from this child for 10 or 15 years. So we have had very, very good success with our programs in dealing with a lot of these, not so much at the family level, but mostly at the kind of the community level.
Let's talk with someone else, someone here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having the program. And just on a personal note, my name is Ken. I'm unfortunately haven't been able to attend any of Machito's presentations. It's glad to have him back, and I hope you'll be in touch after the program. Congratulate him on his tireless efforts at the ground. However, I wanted to also ask him to speak specifically to what I think is a neglected dimension of this conflict. David Hinges sort of framed it only in terms of the ethnic and religious, but this conflict also has, of course, long colonial and roots. Hochschild's work on Leopold's ghost is a good, you know, way into this. And there's the continuing threats to destabilize these peace agreements. Obviously, China's booming economy looms large. So within the notion of not only looking at, you know, the bodies coming down the river, but who's responsible for tossing them in upstream, if Machito could just sort of flag some of the in his field experience, the continuing colonial, you know, notions that still underpin these conflicts way back from British imperialism to current and rising Chinese.
Well, excellent points.
Thanks for the question, Ken. It's a pretty heavy question. I'll try and do my best to answer. But I think across all of these conflicts, the colonial roots are still very much kind of present in setting up kind of very artificial governments, giving power to certain groups over other groups, that kind of resentment. I mean, you can especially look at what happened in Rwanda as one of the huge impacts of that. And also the marginalization of African economies and trying to work through some of the natural resources, such as the diamonds and the oil, and taking advantage of that, thus giving a certain inequity of power out there. I had another point, and I just completely forgot what I was going to talk about. I'm not going to touch on China, which plays a huge role in Sudan right now, but I think for us, and me in particular, being a white male American going into a lot of African conflicts and dealing with a lot of very traditional issues, I mean, my experience overseas and my training here at the University of Illinois has given me certain amount of insight and certainly access to a lot of different tools to facilitate it, but a lot of this has to be homegrown. And for myself, there's a lot of talk right now about the UN going into Darfur I personally disagree with that. I think that this is an opportunity for the AU, the African Union, to really step forward as a body to help Africans deal with problems in Africa. And some of the work that has come out of some of the strong leaders in Africa, I think, have been very good at the mediation, and it's time to take that up a step. I was a little disappointed once I had a chance to understand how the African Union came in to Sudan. They were almost set up to fail with lack of the amount of money that was needed to really provide security and lacks of numbers of personnel, as well as the qualified personnel. But our work with the African Union in Darfur especially has been tremendously positive. The fact that you have African women who speak Arabic and are able to deal with some very sensitive issues for Sudanese women is completely invaluable in us being able to provide support. I mean, it's something that we would never be able to do. And, you know, we have Sudanese staff who are trained, but to have an outsider to be able to come in, the woman's going to be much more free to talk with someone that may not have the cultural backlash to her back to her group. So I think that the West or the UN constantly coming in to do to fix or to protect is a very much a good notion, but I think it's very much the time for the African Union to step up to the plate and to demonstrate that they do have the capacity and they are able to do as good or a better job than the United Nations on their home soil. And I think we've seen a sliver of that, increased funding and increased training for the AU. I think we would see, I would be very much comfortable working alongside of them if they were able to get the funding that they need to go forward.
Do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, just a quick sign off. I mean, I think to Save the Children's credit, they're doing a lot of work in opposition to, you know, the Bob Geldof sort of make poverty history type notion of solving crises, and now the increased role of, you know, Hollywood personalities, Madonna and so forth. So I think the idea, I just wanted to flag, and I think Matita has spoken to this, that these crises are deep and continuing and have multi dimensions and are not going to be amenable to a quick fix solution. So I hope to have a discussion with him. I think he might be staying for Thanksgiving, so I look forward to it, and I'll listen on the radio. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for the call. I don't know if there's anything that you wanted to add to that comment, particularly that comment about the involvement of high-profile celebrities in trying to attract people's attention to various humanitarian issues. And you would have to say, on the one hand, well, if it attracts attention to the issue, that's a good thing. But then on the other hand, you have to say it can't just be a passing kind of attention. It can't be that we pay attention to it for 5 minutes and then we go on to something else.
Yeah, but for us anyway, I mean, one of my former professors here at the University of Illinois was like, when did Hollywood discover that Africa exists? You know, like, it's just been there forever, and now all of a sudden it's the popular hotspot. For us, other than my personal desire to meet celebrities sometimes, being an American I am, we are such a channel surfing culture here, looking at the next conflict, the next show, the next thing that's happening. And if we are able to have Hollywood, which I think America, just passing through a Borders bookstore or going into a supermarket, the amount of Hollywood magazines, Us People, compared to, like, you know, The Economist, obviously, it's a very popular segment of our American culture. And me out in the field, I need money to be able to do these kinds of programs. And if Hollywood is able to provide that attention so people give money so that I can use that money to go out and help more children, I'm all for it. I think that there are some very good spokespeople. George Clooney and I know John Cheadle have been very, very active in Darfur. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing now an increased attention again 2 years later, after seeing some donor fatigue. I don't, you know, how that furthers their career or whatever, doesn't really matter that so much to me, but if it does provide me additional resources, for us to go out and save the lives of more children, then they can have my endorsement.
Yeah. I guess what just as someone who is a complete outsider and is far from being an expert, I guess it, particularly as far as Darfur is concerned, what's really disappointing is that this is not new. This has been going on now for years. And we're talking about such a huge number of people being killed, either directly or indirectly. So many people displaced. I mean, why is it that we just let this keep going?
That's a good question. And people have asked me before, if you could, you know, do anything to stop it, what would you do? And I guess if I had that answer, it's, you know, very, very complex. I wouldn't be probably deputy director of Save the Children. I'd probably be the head of the UN right now, because there's a lot of very smart people that are working on Darfur and that still hasn't been able to crack that nut. I think what's even more disturbing to me, though, is that there are other equally embarrassing, equally disturbing wars happening out there that get no press coverage whatsoever. And you look at the atrocities to children from the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda and what's happening with that, you see very, very little coverage. You see what's still going on in DRC Congo and the persecution of children and the recruitment of children, and that is barely coming up as a point on the radar screen. So there's lots. Even though Darfur and Sudan sometimes is almost underreported or, you know, under-resourced, there's a lot of very vulnerable children out there that are getting nothing at all whatsoever. And we continue to struggle to raise awareness on those kinds of things, the things that don't hit the big CNN, BBC media, and push Congress and our donors to continue to fund us what they can so that we can provide support to the less popular areas of the world that aren't quite so sexy or dynamic.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. We've used our time. Our guest, Matita Watson, is Deputy Country Office Director for Save the Children, and he's now in Sudan, based in Khartoum, has been working in Sudan for a number of years. Before that, did work in the Peace Corps, graduate of the University of Illinois with degrees in African Studies and Community Health. Really pleased he could be here. And I'm sure that if people want to find out more about Save the Children, and if they, not everyone does, but if they have internet access, the easiest way is to go to the website, which is savechildren.org.
No, it's actually www.savethechildren.org.
Oh, the children. Okay, so the you have to do in that. Or you can just put Save the Children into your browser. I'm sure that you will.
It'll come right on
very
up.
Good. Thanks very much.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.